A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what professionally managed accommodation was actually like in the Middle Ages and earlier, and how that experience differed from what we expect when we check into a hotel today. And the short answer is, almost everything was different. The long answer involves bed sharing with strangers, innkeepers who could legally seize your horse, and the fact that privacy as we know it simply didn't exist.
Imagine arriving at an inn after dark in the year 1300. You're tired, you're cold, you've been on the road for days. The innkeeper looks you over, takes your money, and then tells you you'll be sharing a bed with two other travelers you've never met. And if you don't like it, your other option is sleeping outside with the bandits. That was normal. That was the baseline.
The innkeeper wasn't being rude. He was doing his job as the law defined it. Which is one of the things that really surprised me when I started digging into this. The legal framework around innkeeping was wildly different from anything we'd recognize today.
And that's where I want to start, because I think most people assume a medieval inn was just a dirtier, less comfortable version of a modern hotel. It wasn't. It was a fundamentally different institution. We're talking about Western Europe from roughly the year 1000 to 1500, and the inn wasn't a hospitality business in the modern sense. It was more like a regulated public utility. Innkeepers were licensed by local authorities, subject to price controls, and legally required to accept any traveler who could pay. Refusing service was actually a crime.
Which is wild when you think about it. Today, a hotel can refuse you service for basically any reason that isn't a protected class. Back then, turning someone away could get you fined or lose you your license.
And that shapes everything else about the experience. There are really three pillars of difference between the medieval inn and the modern hotel. First, privacy was not a right or even an expectation. Second, security was communal and enforced by the innkeeper's legal liability, which was intense, we'll get to that. And third, comfort was completely secondary to survival. The inn existed to provide shelter, food for you and your horse, and protection from bandits. Everything beyond that was optional.
Let's get into the physical experience. What did an inn actually look like when you walked in?
Picture a building arranged around a central courtyard. That's the template, and it survived for centuries. Ground floor, stables, kitchen, and a common room with a big hearth. Upper floors, dormitory-style sleeping chambers. And I want to emphasize dormitory style, because private rooms did exist, but they were extremely rare and expensive, reserved for nobility or very wealthy merchants. The typical traveler slept in a room with anywhere from 5 to 20 other people.
The beds themselves were not what we'd call beds.
Not even close. We're talking about straw-stuffed pallets on the floor, or if you were lucky, a rope bed, which is a wooden frame with ropes crisscrossed to support a mattress. And here's a fun detail. The phrase, sleep tight, comes from those rope beds. The ropes would stretch and sag over time, so you had to tighten them periodically to keep the mattress from sinking to the floor.
I always wondered about that phrase. So sleep tight is literally about structural integrity.
Structural integrity of your sleeping surface, yes. And these beds were wide, roughly 5 to 6 feet across, because they were designed to hold multiple people. 2 to 4 strangers would share a single bed, fully clothed, often using their belongings as pillows. And you didn't get to choose who you slept next to. Beds were assigned based on arrival order. You showed up, you got placed wherever there was space.
Which means you might be sleeping next to a wool merchant, a pilgrim, or someone who hasn't bathed in 6 weeks.
It was usually the third option. Bathing was not expected. Washing facilities were minimal, maybe a basin of water in the common room. Travelers might go weeks without a full wash. The idea of a private bathroom attached to a bedroom doesn't show up until the late 19th century. The first hotel to offer anything like that was the Tremont House in Boston in 1829, and even that was just private rooms with locks and free soap. Ensuite bathrooms as a standard feature didn't arrive until the Savoy Hotel in London in 1889.
For most of human history, if you were traveling, you were dirty, and you were dirty in close proximity to other dirty people.
The smells were part of the experience. You've got unwashed bodies, damp wool clothing, horses in the stables below, smoke from the hearth, the odor of whatever was cooking, which was usually a single pot of stew that had been simmering for days, with new ingredients thrown in as needed. It's called pottage, and it was the standard inn meal. No menu, no choice, no dietary accommodations. You ate what was served, when it was served, at a communal table with whoever else was there.
The TripAdvisor reviews would have been something. 1 star. The pottage had been simmering since the reign of Edward II.
The innkeeper would have been legally prohibited from charging you more than the town's fixed price for that pottage. Which brings us to the legal framework, and this is where things get genuinely fascinating.
This was the part that blew my mind. The innkeeper wasn't just running a business. He was essentially a quasi-public official.
And this goes all the way back to Roman law. There's a passage in the Digest of Justinian, Digest 4.9, that establishes something called strict liability for innkeepers. The principle is that if a guest's property was stolen while they were staying at the innkeeper had to pay full value, even if they weren't negligent. Didn't matter if they'd done everything right. Didn't matter if they had no idea the theft was happening. They were on the hook.
Which is a much higher standard than we apply to hotels today.
And it carried straight into English common law. The 1285 Statute of Winchester in England codified this. Innkeepers were required to keep guests' belongings safe and to report suspicious characters to the sheriff. If a horse was stolen from the stable, the innkeeper paid. If goods went missing from a guest room, the innkeeper paid. The logic was that travelers were vulnerable. They had no choice but to trust the innkeeper with their property, so the law placed the entire risk on the innkeeper's shoulders.
Let me make sure I understand how this worked in practice. Say I'm a wool merchant traveling through Gloucestershire in 1300. I stable my horse, I go to sleep in the dormitory, and in the morning the horse is gone. Tell the innkeeper he owes me a horse?
You'd make a claim, and if the innkeeper couldn't produce the horse or prove that you'd taken it yourself, he had to pay. And here's the thing, this wasn't theoretical. Court records from the period show innkeepers being sued for stolen horses, stolen goods, stolen money. It was a constant legal exposure. Some innkeepers tried to get around it by posting disclaimers, literally carving notices into the wall saying they weren't responsible for valuables, but courts generally ignored those. The liability was considered part of the license to operate.
It's like if a modern hotel tried to put up a sign saying, not responsible for stolen luggage, and the courts just said, no, you absolutely are.
That's precisely the dynamic, and it created this interesting tension where innkeepers had to be simultaneously welcoming to strangers and deeply suspicious of them. They'd watch new arrivals carefully, ask questions about where they were coming from, what their business was. Not because they were naturally nosy, but because their financial survival depended on not letting a thief through the door.
Which also meant travelers were under scrutiny from the moment they arrived. You weren't just a customer, you were a potential liability.
That's still on the books in a lot of places, isn't it? Hotel liability for lost luggage? In many jurisdictions, hotels are still held to a higher standard of care for guest property than other businesses. That's a direct inheritance from medieval law. Same with the requirement to show ID at check-in, that originates from the medieval requirement that innkeepers know who was in their establishment. Some towns required innkeepers to maintain a guest register and report all arrivals to local authorities. If a guest committed a crime and the innkeeper hadn't recorded their name, the innkeeper could be held liable.
The inn was also a surveillance node for the local government.
And this makes sense when you think about the context. Travel in the Middle Ages was dangerous, roads were bad, bandits were real, and strangers arriving in town were inherently suspicious. The inn was the first point of contact between the traveler and the community, and the innkeeper was the gatekeeper. Their job wasn't just to provide a bed, it was to vouch for the people they were sheltering, or at least to keep records so that if something went wrong, the authorities had a trail to follow.
Which also gave innkeepers enormous power over travelers. If you got on the wrong side of an innkeeper, they could report you as suspicious, and you'd have the sheriff asking questions.
On the flip side, travelers had very little recourse if an innkeeper was dishonest. The price controls I mentioned earlier, many towns set maximum prices for a bed, for stabling, for food. Those weren't consumer protection in the modern sense. They existed because travelers had no alternative. If you arrived in a town at night and there was only one inn, the innkeeper could theoretically charge whatever they wanted. Price controls were a way to prevent exploitation of a captive market.
Which also meant innkeepers had zero incentive to provide quality beyond the bare minimum. If the price is fixed by law, why would you invest in nicer bedding or better food?
The economic incentives push toward mediocrity. And this is one of the biggest differences from the modern hotel industry, where competition drives constant improvement. Medieval inns didn't compete on quality. They competed on location. If you were the only inn on a major pilgrimage route or a busy market road, you had a captive audience. Quality was irrelevant.
The Ryanair business model.
That's actually a perfect comparison. Medieval inns were the Ryanair of accommodation. You got the basic service, you paid a regulated price, and if you wanted anything extra, good luck. But here's the thing about Ryanair. They can at least guarantee you your own seat. A medieval inn couldn't even guarantee you your own bed space. If the inn was full, you might be sleeping on the floor of the common room, using your cloak as a blanket, and you'd still pay the same regulated price.
You could pay full price, and end up on a stone floor next to the hearth ashes.
Count yourself lucky, because the alternative was sleeping outside the town walls, where there was no protection at all. Travelers sometimes forget how much safety we take for granted. The simple act of locking your hotel room door and knowing nobody's going to attack you in your sleep. That's an incredibly recent development in human history.
Let's talk about the transition. How do we get from straw pallets and pottage to the Ritz-Carlton?
It happens in three big waves, and each one is tied to a specific technological or social change. The first is the railway hotel in the mid-19th century. When railways started connecting cities, suddenly you had large numbers of travelers arriving at predictable times in predictable places. That created demand for standardized, bookable rooms near train stations. The railway hotel was the first real break from the medieval model. It was purpose-built for a new kind of traveler.
The second wave?
Elisha Otis demonstrated his safety elevator in 1853, and it completely transformed what a hotel could be. Before elevators, upper floors were undesirable. Nobody wanted to climb six flights of stairs. Hotels were limited to about five or six stories. The elevator made upper floors accessible, which meant you could build taller, which meant more rooms, which changed the economics entirely.
The elevator didn't just make tall buildings possible. It made the modern hotel industry possible.
And here's a detail that doesn't get enough attention. Before the safety elevator, hotels had an inverted prestige hierarchy. The best rooms were on the lower floors because you didn't have to climb. After the elevator, the penthouse became the most desirable real estate. It completely flipped the social geography of the hotel.
That's fascinating. So the phrase, moving up in the world, got a literal architectural expression.
And the third wave was the ensuite bathroom. The Savoy Hotel in London, opened in 1889, was the first to put a private bathroom in every room. César Ritz. Yes, that Ritz had observed that American tourists expected private bathing facilities, and he convinced the Savoy's owner to make the investment. It was a radical break from centuries of shared washing facilities.
Then the Statler Hotel in Buffalo in 1908 really cemented the template. Private bathroom in every room. Fire alarm system, ice water on every floor.
That's the one. The Statler was the blueprint for the 20th century hotel. And by 1900, the modern hotel was basically recognizable. Private rooms, private bathrooms, standardized service, competitive pricing. The medieval inn was dead.
Something was lost in that transition, and I think this is worth sitting with. The medieval inn forced human connection. You shared a bed with strangers. You ate at a communal table. You swapped stories with pilgrims and merchants and soldiers. It was forced sociability, and I'm sure it was often unpleasant, but it was also a kind of community that modern hotels actively prevent.
Modern hotels are designed to minimize human contact. Check-in kiosks, keyless entry, do not disturb signs, room service left outside the door. The entire experience is engineered so that you can go from the lobby to your room and back without speaking to a single person. That's not an accident, it's what customers want. Privacy and autonomy are the core value proposition of the modern hotel.
I want to push back on that a little. Is it what customers want? Or is it what the industry has trained us to want? Because I've stayed in hotels where the design actively discourages lingering in common spaces. The lobby is just a corridor with a check-in desk. There's no bar, no lounge area. You're funneled straight to your room. And I've stayed in places that do the opposite, with big communal tables and shared workspaces, and the vibe is completely different.
That's a fair question. I think there's a distinction between what people say they want and what they actually choose. Survey data consistently shows that travelers value privacy and quiet above almost everything else. But when you look at the fastest growing segments of the accommodation market, it's social hostels, co-living spaces, and boutique hotels that emphasize communal experience. So there's clearly a gap between stated preference and revealed preference.
Or maybe it's generational. Younger travelers who grew up with social media might be more comfortable with the idea of sharing space with strangers. They're already sharing their lives online. Sharing a dinner table doesn't feel like a big leap.
That's an interesting hypothesis, and there's some evidence for it. The rise of boutique hostels that market themselves as social experiences, not just cheap beds. The Selena chain, for example, or the Generator hostels in Europe. They're explicitly targeting millennials and Gen Z travelers. They're essentially selling the medieval inn experience, minus the fleas and the pottage, to digital nomads and young travelers.
The medieval inn, but with Wi-Fi and avocado toast.
And I think that tells us something about what people actually want from travel. The modern hotel solved the problems of privacy, cleanliness, and predictability. But it created a new problem, isolation. The medieval inn created the opposite problem. No privacy, no personal space, but it solved for connection.
Which brings us to the question I want to leave listeners with. As hotels become more automated and contactless, and we're seeing this accelerate with mobile check-in, facial recognition, robot room service, are we losing something valuable? The medieval inn forced human connection, sometimes uncomfortably so. The modern hotel enables isolation. Is there a middle ground?
I think the Japanese ryokan is an interesting model here. It's a traditional inn that's been operating for centuries. Some ryokan have been in the same family for over 1,000 years. You get a private room, usually with a private bath, but the experience is still deeply communal. Meals are served in your room by a nakai-san, a personal attendant who explains the dishes and the local customs. There's an expectation of interaction, of relationship. It's not forced bed sharing with strangers, but it's also not the anonymous transaction of a modern hotel.
The Paradors in Spain, the Gasthofs in Austria. These are all variations on the same idea. Accommodation that retains some of the pre-modern character, the sense of place and connection, without the actual discomfort.
What these models share is that they treat the guest not as a transaction, but as a temporary member of the household. The medieval inn, for all its flaws, operated on the same principle. You weren't a customer in the modern sense, you were a guest in someone's establishment, and that carried mutual obligations. The innkeeper owed you shelter and protection. You owed them payment and good behavior. It was a relationship, not just an exchange.
That's a really useful framing. The shift from relationship to transaction is the through line of this entire history. And I think that's the actionable takeaway here. The next time you travel, try staying somewhere that isn't a standardized chain hotel. Book a ryokan, a parador, a family-run Gasthof. Or if you're feeling brave, book a hostel dorm and see what it's like to sleep in a room with strangers. It'll give you a tiny taste of what travel was like for most of human history.
On the legal side, the next time you check into a hotel and they ask for your ID, or you notice the fine print about liability for lost items, remember that you're touching a legal framework that's over 1,000 years old. The innkeeper's lien, the requirement to register guests, the strict liability for property, these aren't modern inventions, they're medieval.
The innkeeper's lien is particularly interesting. In many jurisdictions, if you don't pay your hotel bill, the hotel has the legal right to hold your property, your luggage, your laptop, whatever you have in the room, until you settle up. That's a direct descendant of the medieval innkeeper's right to seize a guest's horse or goods if they couldn't pay. It's one of the oldest surviving legal principles in commercial law.
It makes sense when you think about it. In the Middle Ages, if a traveler skipped out without paying, the innkeeper had no way to track them down. No credit cards, no online booking records, no small claims court. The lien was the only enforcement mechanism available. The fact that it's still on the books tells you how deeply these medieval practices are embedded in our legal system.
I want to pause on that for a second, because it's remarkable. We're sitting here in the 21st century, and if I walk out of a Marriott without paying, they can legally hold my suitcase. That principle was established before the Black Death, before the printing press.
before the concept of the nation-state in its modern form. The innkeeper's lien predates most of the legal institutions we take for granted. And it survived because it solves a fundamental problem that hasn't changed. How do you enforce payment when the customer is transient and anonymous? The medieval solution was physical. Hold their stuff. The modern solution is digital. Charge their card. Report them to a credit agency. But the underlying logic is identical.
There's one more misconception I want to address before we wrap up. A lot of people assume that medieval inns were dangerous, lawless places, the stereotype of the highwayman's hideout, the den of thieves, and certainly some were. But the legal framework we've been discussing actually made inns relatively safe compared to traveling alone. The innkeeper had every incentive to maintain order. Their license depended on it, and they were legally liable if a guest was robbed. An inn with a reputation for theft would lose business fast, even in an era without Yelp reviews.
Word of mouth was the original review platform.
It was, and it mattered enormously. Chaucer's Canterbury Tales gives us a glimpse of this. The Tabard Inn in Southwark was a real establishment, and it was famous enough to be used as a literary setting. It was large, well-regarded, and served as the gathering point for the pilgrims in the story. But even the Tabard didn't offer private rooms for most guests. Chaucer's pilgrims would have slept in dormitories, sharing beds and swapping stories, which is literally the framing device of the entire book.
The Canterbury Tales is basically a medieval hostel podcast.
That's exactly what it is. 29 pilgrims, stuck together on the road, telling stories to pass the time. It's the original group chat.
I love that. And it underscores the point. The communal nature of medieval travel wasn't just a practical necessity, it was a cultural institution. Storytelling, news sharing, commerce, all of it happened in inns, because inns were the only place where strangers from different regions reliably crossed paths.
Which is something we've almost completely lost. Modern travelers move through the world in private bubbles, private cars, private hotel rooms, private entertainment on personal devices. The idea of striking up a conversation with a stranger at an inn is almost quaint, but for most of human history, that was the point of travel. You didn't just go from place to place, you encountered people along the way.
Those encounters had real economic and cultural consequences. News traveled through inns. Political ideas spread through inns. The Reformation, for example, was accelerated by the fact that travelers carried pamphlets and arguments from town to town, stopping at inns along the way. The inn wasn't just a place to sleep, it was a node in an information network that spanned the continent.
We think of the printing press as the revolutionary communication technology of the early modern period, and it was, but the distribution network for printed material was the inn system. Without inns, those pamphlets don't move.
The infrastructure of ideas was physical. It was roads and inns and travelers willing to carry information from place to place. And the inn was the place where that information was exchanged, debated, and passed on.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1810s, whalers in the Aleutian Islands reported that humpback whale songs contained distinct melodic phrases that repeated every 8 to 12 minutes, patterns that early naturalists described as having the chemical regularity of crystalline structures forming in solution, though they had no way to record or analyze them.
Remarkably specific for the 1810s.
Crystalline whale songs?
Here's the question I want to leave listeners with. As hotels become more automated and contactless, and we're seeing this accelerate, are we heading toward a future where travel is completely devoid of spontaneous human connection? And if so, is that actually what we want?
Or are we going to see a renaissance of communal accommodation, a deliberate turning back toward the medieval model? The rise of co-living spaces and social hostels suggests there's a hunger for it. People don't just want a bed, they want an experience, a story, a connection.
Maybe that's the real legacy of the medieval inn. Not the straw pallets or the pottage or the fleas, but the idea that travel is fundamentally about encountering other people. That's something the modern hotel industry forgot, and something that's slowly coming back.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help other people find the show. We'll be back next week with another weird prompt.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.